And here we go.
Well, hello. On today's episode, we talk about the Art of Video Games exhibit at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Also, life is good. I'm Justin Eisenstadt.
I'm Colin Kakmus.
I'm Sean Holmes.
I'm Benjamin Price.
And you just got to the good part. Strap in and sit tight, because we are boldly going nowhere. Hello and welcome to episode 62 of Boldly Going Nowhere. I'm Justin Eisenstadt.
I'm Colin Kakamas.
I'm Sean Holmes.
I'm Benjamin Price.
And with us, as often,
Why
don't we just go ahead and say, you know, Sean Holmes, I don't know. I'm just squatting, pretty much.
I'm still recovering from yesterday.
So. And your name is still?
Yeah, it's hard to pronounce after that.
I'm still recovering from yesterday.
Words are hard.
Can you remember your name at least?
I'm Brian Massey.
Okay, good.
Yes.
All right.
Brian is our good friend, and we like having him here.
Thank you.
Anyways. I am sweet.
Yes, you are. Just well, he makes a bundle of joy.
There's sugary sweet, like... Yeah. Like life.
So
life is sweet.
Life is sweet.
Life is good.
The sweet
I'm
life.
Happy with life.
It's the sweet life with Zach and Cody.
We got the good life. But not the best life. Because you know what's the best life? Cinnamon life.
Cinnamon life is the best life.
I mean, if regular life is like a 8 out of 10, cinnamon life is like a 50.
Yeah.
It exceeds the scale that we've set for it.
Regular life is... socks with sandals and not caring. Cinnamon life
is digging your toes into the sand.
Is digging your toes into the sand while snorting sugar cocaine.
Yeah. While just a beautiful girl serves you drinks during a sunset.
Yes.
We're really not here to talk about cereal.
I want fucking life cereal.
Are here to talk about is the fantastic event that we went to this weekend. The Art of Video Games exhibit at the Smithsonian Art Museum.
Oh, it's the Smithsonian American Art.
The Smithsonian American. Let's get that straight. It's American art. We don't give a shit about any of you foreigners.
No, it's just that particular museum was strictly American art.
The Louvre can totally suck it.
It's the Smithsonian American Art Museum.
Thank you.
And it was the opening of this exhibit, and along with that, there was a big weekend-long event called Game Fest to celebrate this exhibit, celebrate the art of video games and gaming culture, and how gaming has become fully accepted in the mainstream. So we, in our press capacity, went to cover the event.
Oh yeah, by the way, we were given... press credentials.
Yes, a first on this show.
You mean badges?
Badges. Yes.
And badger, mushroom.
Anyway.
See, those are the kind of things
Snake!
That...
Snake!
See, that's the kind of thing that prevents us from getting that.
Legitimate journalistic...
You're marching us backwards, Sean.
I'm sorry. Go back to reading the Wikipedia page.
For every step forward we take... we take two steps backwards, thanks
with
to
your
you,
banter.
Sean.
I'm Ringo.
You are the Ringo. You're the Ringo of this group.
I put it right here on the refrigerator.
I made a song about an octopus.
It was a cuttlefish.
it was some kind of undersea invertebrate.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So just start describing that, but you know, take your time with it.
So the Art of Video Games is an exhibit curated by... No. Shut it down.
God.
Not today.
We're trying to be serious here about this exhibit.
This is serious business.
It's not cereal. It's serious.
Guys, this is super cereal.
Super cereal.
All right. Continue.
All right. So Chris Melisinos is the curator of this exhibit. He is also the author of the book, The Art of Video Games, which has a much more extensive collection of games than you will find in the exhibit. But the exhibit has over 240 games from across a history of platforms and genres, but the public voted for the 80 that will actually be displayed in the exhibit.
Okay, well, I wanted to make a point, too. The chap that actually started this event. He was a very nice fellow, very cheerful, very open, yeah, and very enthusiastic about this push to put, you know, this movement to get games, at least the interaction aspect of it, was it?
Yeah, Chris Melesinos actually...
As an art form.
Yeah, Chris Melesinos actually, when Ben and I and our photographer went to the press day, because the press got to go a day early.
One. Oh, or the prequel, actually.
Yeah, it was the day before. So it was Thursday. The event opened Friday, and we were the press had a day set beforehand that they could go check it out. We were all waiting for the opening remarks, and Chris Melesinos actually came up to us, you know, shook our hands, started talking to us, and we got into this whole discussion about Tron, you know, because Tron was going to be in the movie playing the following night, and he kept talking to us, and we were like, cool. Because he didn't introduce himself, so we were like, "Who are you?"
Yeah.
And then when he went off and started talking to other people, I'm just sitting there. I was like, "Who was that guy?" And then they started the opening remarks, and then they called him up on stage, and we were like, "Oh, that's the guy who's
And he, in fact, actually, he talked to us first.
Yeah, I know. It was really interesting. He was very approachable.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the thing that shocked me the most about this. You know, you think the Smithsonian, you're thinking, you know,
snobs.
Well, I wouldn't say snobs.
Yeah.
But everyone has a more professional air to them. You know, obviously, because I mean, it is an art museum. You know, video games are not usually considered in a form of high art, which this particular exhibit is trying to change that opinion.
Well, yeah, I think.
And so, you know, people were far more approachable.
It would be a very big difference if they were talking about video games as art as opposed to the art of video games. Because I think most people will easily acknowledge that there is art in video games, but whether video games are themselves art is an extremely controversial subject.
At this time,
one that still does not have a clear answer for most people, because most... I would say mainstream cultural critics are still kind of against the idea, most notably Roger Ebert, who quoted in at least two different times. Here's what Roger Ebert said about video games as art. To my knowledge, no one in or out of the field has ever been able to cite a game worthy of comparison with the great dramatists, poets, filmmakers, novelists, and composers. That a game can aspire to artistic importance as a visual experience, I accept. But for most gamers, video games represent a loss of those precious hours we have available to make ourselves more cultured, civilized, and empathetic. And then the other thing he said is that one obvious difference between art and games is that you can win a game. It has rules, points, objectives, and an outcome. Santiago might cite an immersive game without points or rules, but I would say then it ceases to be a game and becomes a representation of a story, a novel, a play, dance, a film. Those are things you cannot win. You can only experience them.
Well, I have to make a point, too. I have to make a point there. Didn't they have in the movie, I think it was one of the, I can't think of the guy's name, but it was Alfred Hitchcock, actually, had like the ghost, they had these like glasses you used to wear in the theaters back mm-hmm. when he had his movie. When his movies were in theaters, where you can put it on. It was like, I think it was 13 Ghosts was the movie, where you can put these glasses on. You could choose whether or not you can see the ghost or not. You put it on, you can see the ghost, or put it off if you thought it got too scared. Yeah, I think that was the movie that he did it in. He had these glasses. Mm-hmm. They weren't like 3D glasses or anything like that, but I think they worked on the same principle, red and blue kind of deal. But yeah, and that's an interactive effect within a movie.
Well, I think there's a long history of art that is interactive.
Yes.
Right, and we actually...
Many art exhibits are interactive.
Yeah, and the thing is, when we were talking with Chris, we actually had this discussion. We actually interviewed Chris Melesinos, and one of the questions I asked him was, because for the longest time, and certain people still believe this, video gaming is more considered a leisure pursuit.
Yeah.
Not a form of art. And I asked him, do you believe that this exhibit is going to start changing more people's attitudes towards video games being a form of art? And obviously, I'll let you listen to the interview to get the answer on that.
Yeah, yeah. I'd also say that if you want to see a more professional, intellectual take on this topic, you should check out Extra Credits, because this is one of many topics that they've heavily devoted attention to. But I would say, personally speaking, I don't actually necessarily disagree with Roger Ebert on a number of points. One being that video games, at the end of the day, are about being fun. If you're striving to make a game that is art form, you are failing to recognize the point of what a video game is. Now, that being said, fun, making something fun, is not a science. It is an art. You cannot define what makes something fun only through experiencing it. Something is either fun or it's not, and that's a completely subjective decision, just like art.
Yeah, that's what I was going to make a point. Yeah.
So that's why I think that they are ultimately overall, but maybe not in the same way that classic or traditional art is considered art. So fun is an art, but maybe video games themselves are not an art. You can have elements of them that are art.
Well, one of the things that they were presenting as evidence that they were in fact art was, you know, obviously the concept art was a big thing, and like, you know, one of the things that they had, which was more or less just like for fun, was they some guy, I forget who did it, but he did like the Halo Atari cartridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, that was interesting.
I forget who that guy was.
Speaking of which, about that real quick, one of the staff members actually had that version of that game on his phone.
Really?
That's pretty cool. It's an actual game. You can get on your smartphones.
Was it called like Halo 2600?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. So it's a version of Halo made for the Atari 2600.
Yeah, and that's an actual game too.
The Warthog is still hard to control.
I think regardless of whether we're going to get into the subject, because again, this is a topic that you could spend all day debating.
Mm-hmm.
The exhibit was pretty freaking awesome,
no doubt.
And there are really cool works of art in this exhibit. And I think video games. The reason I'd kind of agree with Roger Ebert that video games themselves are not art is because a video game is comprised of so many different elements. So like the concept art, that is a piece of art. The you know, the particular, like a song or the music that is in the game, that could be a piece of art. The story, that can be a piece of art. But the video game is a total package. It's hard to draw the line on that, because
it's hard to focus on any one single element. Now, to be honest, this particular exhibit is focusing more
just
on
the visuals,
the visual aspect, and in that case, it is succeeding. That is art.
Yeah. So in that case, there's no doubt this is definitely an art exhibit.
Yes.
Because there's some really friggin' cool stuff in there.
Yes.
Well, here, why don't we do this? Since now we're talking about the actual exhibit, why don't we go around everyone? Let's say what was our favorite bit of the exhibit, and then what could we wish we could have seen? All right, okay. Let's start with Ben.
Okay, my favorite part of the exhibit was actually the layout. Mm-hmm. The overall, the way they had everything set up, where you can play like the 3-minute demos of various games, like Mario? Yeah, Mario Brothers,
Pac-Man,
and
they had Myst.
Myst.
Secret of Monkey Island.
Secret of Monkey Island,
and what was the other one?
Flower.
Yeah.
All right.
Which I thought was a bit of an odd choice, but.
You know, you got to take what you get. All right, Ben. So that was your favorite. Now, yeah. What could you wish you could have seen?
What I could have seen there, actually, a Kinect in the exhibit.
Okay,
they didn't feature that, as well as maybe the aspect of music. Really,
okay.
In the games.
Well, yeah, but being that this is a visual art museum, I can kind of see why they.
Yeah.
Didn't
we can really understand. Yeah, we can understand why they didn't go with that, but I can understand. Yeah, I can understand that. All right, so my favorite moment. It's a tie down to three moments, really. And I hate to go through all three, but they're all three equally pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go through each three of them. Number one was the Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari, did a panel on Friday, which Sean, I, Justin and our video camera operator Laura Harding got to go to, and it was really entertaining. I mean, yeah. I don't think I've been more enthralled at a panel before.
I think we'll come back to the Nolan Bushnell panel because I do want to go into that in more detail.
The second thing was my roommate came down with us on Saturday, and during the and as Ben said earlier, each game had you could play, but you could only play for about 3 minutes because they had to get people moving through there.
A select set of demos to give you an example of
what. Well, and see, the thing was, the majority of people who played through Mario couldn't get past like the fourth level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they made it there,
right? If they even made it there, which most of them did not.
They just went through the.
James on his first attempt got to World 8-1.
Yep.
And it was right as he got to 8-1, he got like maybe like a quarter of the way through the level, and the game cut off.
Yeah.
And so I was inquisitive, so I went to one of the people who were you know working the exhibit as staff, and I was like, all right, level with me. How far has somebody gotten on that? It's like, oh, some dude just got to 8-1. I'm like, you mean him? He's like, yeah, that dude. So James got the furthest out of anybody who'd been through that
That's
exhibit.
Awesome.
Yes.
Oh, speaking of that, too, a lot of other people also made that same comment that he was the only one.
Right. He was the only one. Like, I had gotten to 8-1, but the game had literally shut off right after I got to 8-1.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, he had a pretty sizable crowd watching him as well, and they were getting into it.
Yeah, they were getting into it. If he had gotten any further, people probably would have started going apeshit. Yeah. But so that was another good moment. And then probably, the last one is another friend of ours was there on Wednesday, and because there was another panel that I wanted to go to, but I ended up missing because we were recording. Friday. I'm sorry. Friday is what I meant. Rand Miller, the creator of Myst, was there, and he was doing a panel. My friend William Davey was actually there. He was playing the Myst demo, and Will knows the back door, how to get right to the end of the game. And Will was going through it, and he was one frame off from finishing. And while he was, doing that, Rand Miller was in the group of people that were assembled behind him and was actually watching him work his way through the game. And Will didn't even notice that the guy who created the game was there cheering him on.
That's pretty awesome. I wish I'd been there for that.
That was pretty badass.
That's epic.
Yeah.
All right, so
Justin?
I guess it's my turn.
What was something that you didn't like?
Well, I wouldn't say there wasn't anything I did not like.
I guess things that you wanted to see that you didn't.
One thing I wish. No, he did. He was the incision of music was what Ben said.
Right.
But I would say probably the biggest bummer was, and this is probably what a lot of other people's is going to be, but it's a valid point. There weren't any handheld consoles.
Yes.
No Game Boys. No Game Gears. No PSPs. No Vitas. No DS's, no DS lights. I mean, nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. I mean, I understand.
No WonderSwan colors.
Yes. No. What was the Atari one? The Atari
Lynx.
The Atari Lynx.
Lynx.
Yeah. There was no handhelds, and that was a shame because no Pokemon.
Which means, yeah, I was going to say, sorry, boys and girls, no Pokemon.
Actually, in a sense, because I saw, because I was in line. Y'all got to go inside. Meanwhile, I was in line for like 30 minutes with James, and so. So anyways, you could say that portables were there because every kid I saw in line had a 3DS.
That doesn't count.
Yeah, I mean,
so
yeah, it's just a testament to how glaring an error it was that they didn't.
Yeah.
Because how I mean, even like guys our age, you see so many guys our age just who are tethered to their DSs everywhere they go.
Let's try to put it in their perspective. They have to cover the gamut of 40 years of development within a limited amount of space.
True, because and portable consoles kind of have their own, like, separate timeline of history.
Precisely. So, I mean, I can understand why they did it, although I would say that probably that was the only thing that I felt could have been included.
Yeah. But, I mean, considering the Game Boy is still one of the best-selling consoles of all time, not just handhelds, but consoles
all,
in general,
yeah,
it is still kind of conspicuous.
Yes.
So.
I mean, you could have had a Game Gear there, you know.
But, I mean, it happens.
You could have your own separate section. Just
I mean, they've probably gotten, like, hundreds of comments saying, oh, why wasn't this there? Why wasn't that there?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right. My turn.
Yes.
So what would?
So this is going to be a bit of. I think this is going to sound like a bit of a cheesy comment or a bit of a cop out because it's hard for me to pick any one element mm-hmm. of the exhibit itself that stood out to me. I would really say that the greatest thing about the exhibit for me, seeing the reactions of the crowd, because more so than maybe any other exhibit in that museum or any exhibit in any museum that I can think of, save for the rock and roll. The Experience Music Project in Seattle, which still is my favorite museum I've ever been to. It's the Experience Music Project / Sci-Fi Museum.
Wow.
If you guys are ever in Seattle...
I've heard of that.
It's the best museum I've ever been to.
Just an offside. Isn't Captain Kirk's chair in there?
Yes. Every piece of sci-fi memorabilia you can think of is in this museum.
Sweet.
And the Experience Music Project is even cooler. I mean, they have, like, a gallery of guitars... They have an actual interactive room where you can basically jam with other people on, like, really classic guitars. Anyways, that's neither here nor there. But what my point was is that more so than maybe any other exhibit that I've seen in a museum, this is something where most of the people coming into this are already experts on the subject. So whereas most exhibits, you're going in there to learn something, you're going in there to kind of for the intellectual stimulation, something that you've never seen before. This is something that everyone coming there is intimately familiar with. They're not seeing anything, for the most part, that they haven't seen before. Now, I was surprised at the number of, like, obscure games that they actually had and systems, so I'm not saying you're not going to learn something or see something new. But walking through this exhibit, it is kind of surreal seeing consoles that most of us own at home encased in glass.
Exactly. Like, that. It was just so weird because, like, I saw, like, a PS2 there. It was framed in glass, and they were talking about, like, Metal Gear Solid and all these different games were, like, the classics for it. Meanwhile, the previous night, I had just watched a DVD in mine.
Right.
And it was just like, this is kind of odd. This is really bizarre.
Right. This isn't
like... I don't enjoy it, but...
Right. This isn't like seeing, you know, some kind of abstract sculpture or, like, a painting or something that you will never personally own. This is something that we all have. This is something that we all know intimately... And it really is less of an intellectual activity than a nostalgic one.
Like, the way I described it to you the other night was, it was kind of like a dream. It was kind of like, it's kind of like, you know, waking up from a dream and going, guys, you won't believe this. I was at the Smithsonian, but I was playing Mario.
Yeah.
It was just weird.
That, and you can also own it, too. If you don't have these systems, you can actually go, like, on the internet and get...
There go. You can go buy a used one for $50, you know.
eBay. There you go.
And, so that's really cool. And as I was saying, there were some surprisingly obscure games that they had in there. For example...
This is when you were flipping through the book, right?
Well, book, but also in the actual exhibit, because they had three or four different iterations of the Panzer Dragoon series, which was is like a kind of shooter, like flight shooter game where you're riding a dragon. And it only came out, it started on the Sega Saturn, and then they did have a version that came out on Xbox. But the original Sega Saturn versions are incredibly rare. Like, they're very expensive games to find, because the Sega Saturn in general is kind of a rare system, but especially those games. So, for them to have not one, but three different Panzer Dragoon games in this exhibit, when most people will probably very unlikely to ever see an actual copy of that game, is interesting.
Let me ask you a question. I guess we could look through it if, like, we don't know.
God damn.
That is most definitely unprofessional.
That's
remember,
a party foul.
I think I recall saying, mute your phone. Before the podcast starts.
That's a spanking.
Oh, jeez.
Benjamin, do my laundry.
That was the number I don't even know.
Let me ask you a question, Justin. For the Sega Saturn, did they feature... There's a game that a lot of people like. Did they feature knights?
Knight on Sega Genesis?
Yeah, no, on the Saturn.
Or Sega Saturn. Right, you're that kind of like little flying...
Yeah.
Like jester-looking thing? No, they didn't.
The fuck?
I mean, that's a pretty obscure one, too. And another one, flipping through the book, now this wasn't in the actual exhibit, but flipping through the book, they had things like Dune 2 Battle for Arrakis, Like, that is incredibly obscure. And I'm thinking, hey, if you can have that, you should... Why not have Baldur's Gate in there? Baldur's
the pixels
Gate 2. Because Baldur's Gate 2, to me, is a PC game, has some of the coolest art in any PC game that I've ever played.
That actually reminded me. I actually played that game, The Battle for Arrakis.
Really?
Yeah. That it was actually kind of hard to play.
Hmm.
I do remember, now that you mentioned it, I just remembered the moment when I actually played it. I played it for about a good solid 2 weeks.
Okay, so Justin, let's hear. What did you wish you could have seen?
I'll second the thing about handhelds. I'll second that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would have liked to see more interactive games. I would have liked to see, because it's when I'm walking through this exhibit, the second room, not the room that had the actual ones you could play, but just the ones that had sort of the gallery of games. It just made me want to play those games. I'm like, oh, I wish I could just actually play the game. And I realized it would be impractical to have, you know, 80 different games that you could actually play. There just wouldn't be space for it. It would be a whole mess. I realize that. But it's still, there's something about seeing video games that just instantly makes you want to sit down and play a video game.
Okay, I got
cough,
that.
Brahms, cough.
Right. So, yes. I guess I was just like, that's not even really a comment on the video game exhibit itself. It just made me want to play video games. So I'll just second the handheld thing.
Okay. All right, Sean.
Yes?
So what would you say you enjoyed the most about the exhibit?
I would say the music, first and foremost. I really enjoyed Triforce Quartet.
Yes.
It's been a while since I sat there and listened to my favorite franchise Zelda being played, like, and across the whole gamut, all the ones I played, and they skipped over the lesser ones I didn't really spend too much time with, like Wind Waker. They touched on it a little bit and they moved on, which is good. And but they spend most of their energy on Skyward Sword for a little bit, which I think was very, you know, on the beat, and just, it's out there, you know, it's really good. I think that, you know, like you guys were saying earlier, like, handheld games could have been in there, but that's fine with me, too, because I realized that when they put this up in the first place, you know, they wanted to appeal to everybody, and to put, just jam in so too much stuff, mm-hmm, would be, you know, overcomplicating it, and people would kind of, okay, it would kind of shy away from it. This was simple, and it was very approachable.
Okay, so what would you wish you could have seen?
What I wish I could have seen, I would say, like, maybe one or two handheld things, like the old Game Boy or the new thing, and some of the stuff coming up, like some of the, like since we have the past, and we should have something like there's the present, which what are our current consoles right now,
mm-hmm,
for the current gen consoles, and then what do we have to look forward to? We saw a little bit of that in Nolan Bushnell's.
Right, and we'll go back to that.
We'll go back to that. But I think that they should have had something where this past, present video games, future, where is it going?
Yeah.
And I think that would it, and put it in a linear place. And that the whole TV tube screen thing, I don't know why that wasn't a part of it.
Yeah. Oh, I just thought of this. You know what's one game I am, like, shocked was not in this exhibit?
What?
Okami.
Yeah, it was.
Where was it?
PS2.
Oh, I didn't even... probably because I was expecting to see it on the Wii.
Yeah. No, it started on as a PS2 game.
It did start, but it was in the PS2?
Yeah.
All right, well, never mind. I just failed as a person visiting the exhibit that I failed to see Okami and then actually left and said, man, I wish they had Okami.
Dude, it was featured.
I definitely enjoyed Tron, though. Tron was amazing.
All right, never mind. Stand corrected.
Yeah,
all right, Tron. Brian.
All right, Brian, favorites.
Well, one of the things that I really liked about this exhibit was that despite everything else, it didn't seem like it was overly commercialized. Like, you didn't see people hawking T-shirts everywhere. You didn't, mm-hmm, see booth babes or something that you'd see at, like, E3 or, hell, even MAGFest. It was a very simple, clean-cut, kind of like throwing everything together and screw, you know, corporations. It's just, this is what it is. This is an exhibit. You know, all, you know, money be damned. What I liked about it was... Yeah, Ben?
No, I'm going to say something right after your segment.
Okay. Well, what I was, one of the things I really liked about it too was obviously going in and playing some of the games. Again, you know, Pac-Man, Super Mario Brothers, Flower. Flower. But yeah, it was like, one of the things that I really enjoyed though was watching these kids that were like, you know, they were younger, trying to play Super Mario Brothers. And I just thought it was hilarious because the majority of them, not all of them, but the majority of them could not find the start button on the controller. I was like, are you kidding me?
That's funny.
You know, because like our generation, like we grew up with that.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of funny. Meanwhile, like they're failing. Meanwhile, you know, one of us gets to 8-1 in 3 minutes. It's just, you know, it shows the different generations. Another thing I did like was just how they exhibited everything, just how everything was. It seemed clean, and it did seem to go in a linear fashion. So you could literally walk through the time of consoles. You know, you could definitely see how things progressed.
Yeah.
Which was very good.
Okay, what would you say you wanted to see more of?
Well, obviously there's some games that were missing. Mega Man was one of them for me. But that's because I'm a big Mega Man fan. But strikingly was Pokemon. Because Pokemon's such a huge franchise.
Right. Well, I think that goes back to the whole handheld thing.
It does. But it does go back to the whole handheld thing. But Pokemon, you have Mario, you have Zelda, and then you have Pokemon. That's how important that franchise is to Nintendo.
Yeah.
And it was just a glaring omission for me. So was Tetris, and so was an exhibit on, say, music. But then again, they were focusing on such a small thing in such a small wing. So for what it was,
I would like to see God of War. That game had some awesome art.
Like I said, man, they probably have...
There's just so many.
They probably had like a list, like a whole slew of people come in and say, why didn't you have this? Why didn't you have that? It's like, well...
Right. You could go do that until the cows come out. We could go on,
but they had three of the best Zelda games there. I mean, you can't fault them for that, though.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, they never really... I mean, other than some of the game designers that were actually... that came there, they never actually, with an exhibit, really featured the game designers themselves. Like, tried to put notoriety so much to some of the key figures that designed these games. You know, the artist.
That's true. I mean, they had little placards that had the name of whoever was responsible for the art design, but not prominently, and it was very easy to overlook.
No, wasn't even, overall. That actually wasn't even, I think, out of all of them, I think on those placards, they only list, like, the director and producers.
Yeah.
Which was good, because I got to see Shigeru Miyamoto's name in the Smithsonian, so.
You would think they'd have, like, the key figures, just overall, they got these things going.
Yeah, but they probably could have had a little small section, just pictures of the actual people who worked on those games.
You know, or just something small, just in general, the key figures that we probably, the people that are going there would have recognized.
This is just an offside, but something I would have loved to see is, say, photos of the dev crews on this, like, back in the day, like, where they were doing it and how they were doing it and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, in the really early days of video games, developers didn't even get credit in the game. I mean, they didn't even put their names in the credits. Because the actual the first ever Easter egg in video game was an adventure, and the guy who coded that game put a secret room where it just said, this game coded by whatever his name was, because back then they didn't even put those guys in the credits. Mm-hmm. It's just the company took full credit for the game. So,
which in kind of overall, that actually, at least the understanding of the history of it, that led to a lot of companies being formed because they said, hey, you guys are making a lot of money off of me and I'm not getting any credit. I'm not getting a cut of it. So a lot of these engineers that created these games for these first companies actually broke off and created these other companies.
I think this is a really good segue to talking about Nolan Bushnell's panel.
Yeah.
So Nolan Bushnell, if you're not familiar with him, considered one of the fathers of the gaming industry. He is the founder of Atari, creator of Pong.
No, that's Al Alcorn's technically the guy who did Pong, but...
Right, yes, that's true.
Yes.
But
technically, Bushnell was paying him, so by proxy, yes, you could say
that. Yeah.
Well, yes. But he was the founder of Atari.
Yes.
And he also invented Chuck E. Cheese, which is cool, I guess.
it's cool, I guess.
So I can say, you know, we can safely say Nolan Bushnell is responsible for a lot of drunken brawls among families.
It's a cool Chuck place.
What was that statistic you were telling me the other day?
I want to find it. I wonder if they have it in
Wait, let me ask you this. Was he also responsible for Showtime Pizza, or were those two totally
different instances? Chucky...
Showbiz Pizza, you're thinking?
Yeah. I don't think he was responsible for that. It was Chuck E.
No,
Cheese.
No, Showbiz Pizza Pals, they were.
Well, no, I mean, not when they started.
Actually, you know something kind of funny? In California, I think it's in California or it's in Washington State, but they actually have a convention, and it's for Chuck E. Cheese and Showbiz Pizza enthusiasts. So they'll show off, like, the animatronics and all that, and I've seen photos, and it's really bizarre.
Yeah. I did find an article, Conduct at Chuck E. Cheese described as madness.
Conduct at Chuck E. Cheese?
Oh. yeah. There's a 22-second clip. Is the latest example of what police describe as a disturbing and bizarre crime trend, escalating violence among adults at a place designed for children's birthday parties. So yeah, the funny thing about Chuck E. Cheese is it has a oddly high incidence of drunken brawls between adults. Something about going to Chuck E. Cheese just drives people to drink.
Like, do they even serve beer there?
No, people show up drunk.
Well, no, they do serve alcohol at some.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's your problem.
But most people just bring their own.
Right, but you also have to remember that, I mean, he may have started Chuck E. Cheese, but I'm pretty sure he was far removed from that whole thing.
Actually,
far after that.
Actually, honestly, if I was forced to go to Chuck E. Cheese, I think I'd drive myself to drink too, so.
Anyway.
Anyway,
and after that long tangent, let's go back to Nolan Bushnell's panel.
Yeah. So Nolan Bushnell gave a really entertaining talk. I mean, I was actually not expecting it to be that entertaining. I mean, I was expecting it to be informative and interesting. Did not realize he was actually going to be that entertaining. He's a funny guy, and it was really entertaining. He went through his history, and he looked at sort of what gaming is achieving today in the art department and some of his projects that he's working on. And I like the fact that he's kind of self-deprecating, but at the same time is very confident in what he talks about, which makes him really likable. Because, you know, he talked about, you know, here's some of the mistakes that I made.
I know. Like,
One of them being turning down a third of Apple
for $50,000.
$50,
he's like, yeah, that one still hurts. I'm like, yeah. What was another one? Another one was he was talking about he showed an ad for one of the first games Atari put out, which was Computer Space.
Yeah.
I think that was the name of the game, Computer Space. That was their version of it. And there was a picture of this lady in, like, a nightgown in the promotional ad for it. And she was posing next to the machine, right? And he's like, by the way, that lady in the ad, yeah, she was a stripper. That was a whole other... That's a whole other story, though.
Oh, by the way, just if anyone is still curious, I did find the article that I was talking about Chuck E. Cheese. It was in the Wall Street Journal. That's how big a deal this was.
Holy crap.
They
need to start, like, a Chuck E. Cheese bike.
You know what? Why don't you do me a favor? Attach that to that. Attach this, like,
I'll put
a link
this on
that.
The blog or
yeah,
something.
Attach this to the blog.
Officers have been called to break up 12 fights, some of them physical, at the child-oriented pizza parlor since January 2007. The biggest melee broke out in April when an uninvited adult disrupted a child's birthday party. 7 officers arrived and found as many as 40 people knocking over chairs and yelling in front of the restaurant's music stage where a robotic singing chicken and the chain's namesake mouse performed. And also, 70%, so you were right, 70% of Chuck E. Cheese restaurants serve beer and wine.
Damn. Well, you know, hey, I mean...
Box wine.
It was like something out of a Quentin Tarantino film.
Chucky Crunk.
Chucky Crunk.
This is a great quote. It was like something out of a Quentin Tarantino film. What parent is going to take their kids to a place where there's alcohol and pistols being brandished? All right, let's get back to Nolan Bushnell.
Yeah, speaking about Nolan Bushnell.
So the one part that was really bizarre, though, that I think we have to talk about, because the talk was great. What happened at the end of the talk? Not so much. So...
Huh.
At the end of the presentation, and clearly Nolan Bushnell had no idea that this was going to happen. This was clearly not planned. At the end of the presentation, Billy Mitchell and Walter
Day.
Walter Day, that's what I thought his name was. Who, if you've seen the movie King of Kong
or Chasing
or
Ghosts,
Chasing Ghosts, both documentaries about arcade gaming, they're kind of well known now at this point because King of Kong was a pretty huge documentary. Like, a lot of people saw it. So these guys are somewhat famous. So I guess that's why they have kind of the pull that they could just kind of do this kind of thing. They came out and they were like, Nolan, you are a great figure. You know, Newsweek cited you as one of 50 individuals who changed America. You've had all these awards and accolades, but we have something that I think tops every award you've ever gotten. And you can see he's just like, oh, okay. They brought out a giant novelty trading card, holographic trading card, with Nolan Bushnell's face on it. And then, like, on the back, you know, a little blurb, his bio and stuff. And I think they were hoping that he was going to be like, wow, this is so cool. No one's ever done something like this for me. This is so creative, and I'm so, you know, this is so cool. Instead, Nolan Bushnell was just like, that's cool.
And thanks, guys.
Thanks, I guess.
Card.
He had no idea what was happening. And then not only that, but these two guys, Billy and Walter, proceeded to milk that thing for all it was worth. They needed, you know how at the Academy Awards they'll start playing the orchestra music?
Yeah,
and you go
God
on
knows
long.
We needed some of that.
They actually, yes, Chris Milicinos came on to take the microphone and be like, all right, guys, let's move on. And they actually cut him off. They cut off
the
curator
yeah.
of the entire event. They cut him off so they could keep talking. And I'm just like, this is so awkward that right now what we are watching unfold on stage is so uncomfortable.
And we have to go get, you know, they were running out of time because everyone had to go to Tron to go sit down and watch the
right.
movie.
So because of Billy Mitchell and Walter Day, they had to get rid of the Q&A. They were going to have a Q&A with Nolan Bushnell. They had to actually cancel that because these two dudes came up there and hijacked the whole thing. So no one got to ask Nolan any questions. All right. Well, that, I would say, that was a weird part. That was really weird. But seeing Tron was awesome.
Seeing Tron was probably getting our picture with Nolan Bushnell, that was the highlight of that entire event. Seeing Tron was also good.
Yeah. We networked. We met a lot of really cool people, exchanged business cards, made some cool contacts.
Yes. Actually, we do have to give a couple thanks to some people.
Laura Baptiste
and the team over at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. We owe them a great deal of thanks. They were extremely helpful, you know, giving us the press credentials. Not only that, but trying to help us out getting some of the interviews that we're going to be putting up along with the pictures and videos we took. You know, they were very instrumental in getting that for us. And then they were so nice to us when we were actually at the event. You know, so, I mean, so many things need to go to them. Chris Melcinos, we need to thank him as well for not only interviewing us, but also,
yes.
I mean, basically conceiving the event. Let's see, there was someone else.
Bringing video games to the Smithsonian, thank him.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, because the majority of the collection, like, I would say at
it's
least...
his personal stuff.
Yeah, 50 to 60% of that collection was his.
Which he was later on realizing that he wish he had kept some of the stuff. Because
right, he half jokingly stated that, you know, I'm not going to see this collection again until my daughter's in her first semester of college, because this, I mean, a lot of people don't know this that went to that event, but this particular exhibit is actually going to be touring the country after it's done at the Smithsonian. This exhibit's actually ongoing until 2015.
Yeah, the exhibit will only be at the Smithsonian until September 30th.
Of this year.
Yeah.
And then it will start moving around from museum to museum.
Yeah.
So we want to thank them. We need to thank the members of Triforce Quartet for giving us the interview.
Chad, Matt, Rebecca, and Chris.
Yes.
The fourth one. So thank you to them for performing. And
yes,
also
because that was
giving
awesome.
Us a great interview.
Yes. Let's see. Who else?
Fragdoll Girl? Because she did kind of interview us.
Yes, let's see here.
I can't think of her name. It's
it was
slips me.
Kimberly, what's her? Saber. She goes by Saber on the Fragdolls site.
Awesome. Yeah, I can't wait for that to come out.
Really
we'll plug that on the website.
Yes. So, to all those and those we didn't get to, I mean, we want to thank you all for, you know, making this event possible and then making it fun for us. I would suggest all of our listeners that if you're anywhere in the Washington, D.C. area, go to this event. It's at the Smithsonian. It's free.
Free.
It's free.
I mean, there's no better price than free, really.
Yeah.
It's really
the,
it's
the best of prices. And then if you're interested in this event anywhere else in the country, look it up on the Smithsonian page. I'm more than positive they're going to link up every single stopping point for this exhibit. Please make sure you go and see it, because the only way gaming is going to be more widely accepted, you know, in our culture is if more and more people become aware of its presence as a medium.
Well,
the
this is
more
definitely a big
you
step.
Know.
Yeah.
I'd love to hold on. I'd love to see how this exhibit does in like the Midwest.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. Right. Well, it's a
considering
big step
the video
forward.
Game Hall of
I
Fame
think
is
we should
in
wrap it up
cuz
we're almost going into an hour.
Yeah, well, yay. We're done here. I realize this wasn't the funniest episode, but I do think this was a really cool experience, and I hope that we've managed to convey that to everyone and that people who can will go see the exhibit and experience what Chris and the gaming industry has created. So, until next time, I'm Justin Eisenstadt.
I'm Colin Kakamas.
I'm Sean Holmes.
And I'm Benjamin Price.
And we are boldly going nowhere.
Outro.
Boldly Going Nowhere is a Castwave Studios production. For other shows and more, visit castwavestudios.com. That sounded great.